Hi, this is Bill Turnbull from Faith Matters Foundation. We are introducing a series of podcasts called Deep Dives, where we go deep on a particular subject with a particular guest. And this one is about the spiritual practice of meditation and mindfulness. And it's a discussion about how we can grow and develop through our adult lives. My guest is Thomas Worthland McConkie, a young man from the most prominent of Mormon families who returned to engagement with the Mormon Church after a long self-imposed exile. And he returned bearing gifts. Thomas lives now in Salt Lake City, teaches and coaches around mindfulness and adult development, and is the author of the book Navigating Mormon Faith Crisis, A Simple Developmental Map.
And I remember my mom turning to me, and she said, "Would you like a blessing from your granddad?" This was my granddad, Worthland. And he lived just a few blocks away. And it was just like the moment she asked me that question, something in me opened up, something lit up. And I said, "Of course I want a blessing. That sounds like the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my whole life." And, you know, my granddad was a busy guy. He was an apostle at the time. And I imagine he dropped everything and drove up and kicked the snow off his boots and came in from the cold, wet night. And the family went into the living room and the man laid his hands on my head. And it was absolutely transcendent what happened to me in that moment. I mean, I was 12 years old. I didn't have any language to comprehend what was going on, or limited language to make sense of it. But I knew by the direct experience in my body that there was a power and a light moving through me that was not of this world.
Join us for this deep dive with Thomas Worthland McConkie. Hi, everyone. This is Bill Turnbull. I'm here with my good friend Thomas McConkie. I'm one of the co-founders of Faith Matters Foundation, and we met, what, a year or so ago?
October 2015.
Oh,
good for you. Right when the book came out.
Yeah, a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
We were at dinner at a friend. Somebody invited me, said, "Hey, you come to dinner. You need to meet this guy. He's like this... he's writing a book on how to navigate Mormon faith crisis." And that's, you know, I have enough friends have enough of that in my past that subject interests me. And so, I said, and the story, the name was Thomas Worthland McConkie. I said, that's about as interesting as it could be. So I said, "Yeah, sure, I'm there." And we sat down and had dinner. You were there with then, was Glow your fiance at that point?
Girlfriend.
No, just
we
girlfriend.
Were dating at the time.
You weren't even engaged yet.
Yeah.
Now happily married and buying a house, all that good stuff.
Yep, living the dream.
Yeah. So, just a little background. So you are on the faculty at Pacific Integral Institute, which is in Seattle, in the Seattle area. You are an author. You're working on your second book.
Diligently.
Yeah, which I can't. We've been kind of working together on that a little bit.
Yeah.
You also have a new web presence where you actually, why don't you tell us a little bit about Lower Lights?
Yeah, I mean, just for a moment, I moved back from China in 2011, and people started asking me about mindfulness. You know, when I started mindfulness in the late 90s, it was totally obscure. It was countercultural to meditate. And coming back from China in 2011, everybody was wanting to learn mindfulness because they've read that it will help them in their relationships, it will help stress reduction, it will improve their health, and you know, mental acuity. So everyone wants to learn mindfulness. We started having people over just to our house Wednesday nights back in like the very beginning of 2012. And it's just a community that's organically grown in Salt Lake City over the last 5 years. And it's opened up broader questions around what is a contemplative life? What does that look like in secular society? But also, like, what does a contemplative Mormon life look like? Mm-hmm. And it's also during that time that I was starting to teach mindfulness a lot more, one of my friends introduced me to the founders of Pacific Integral, who are really pioneers in the field of adult development. So they took me in and trained me as a facilitator and as a developmental researcher. And so the bigger question, which I think we're really going to get into in this conversation, is how do human beings grow? What are the practices that really grow us? And what does Mormonism have to say about that conversation?
Yeah.
So that's very much what Lower Light, that is the key question that the Lower Lights community is engaging. How do we grow? How do we grow individually? And how do we grow in community?
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you managed to somehow take tough questions and turn them right back around. So one of our friends said, he's like Kung Fu Panda, man.
Did I just do that?
You did. No, you didn't, but you okay. will.
No, I will.
You will in this conversation any number of times. I'll get Kung Fu Panda. But yeah, take these difficult questions that can often be divisive and actually turn them around into a question about how we can grow. And I think that's what, and I think what you didn't say also that this, there's a group that meets once a month in Salt Lake that's you call the Sangha, which is
Lower Light Sangha.
Yeah, Lower Light Sangha.
Yeah, we meet once a month on South Temple in a really big, I call it like Stadium Zen.
Started right? out being your living room, and now it's like this big thing.
It's
yeah.
a bunch of people. And I think over, in 2017, this calendar year, we'll have more gatherings, more on a weekly basis, and yeah. we're starting to roll that out.
It's filling a real need. It's quite an experience, actually. I've been to a couple of those, and I go whenever I can. But
thanks, Bill, yeah.
You're also offering some of these practices, teaching some of these practices in online offerings, which they can. So your website is Lower. What is your website? Lowerlights.org?
Lowerlights.slc.
Lowerlights.slc. Lowerlights with an S.
Yeah.
SLC.org. So go there and you can kind of see what. All the great things you're doing. I love Lower Lights. Just last week in sacrament meeting, we had this double quartet, or octet, male octet singing that, Let the Lower Lights Keep Burning. And
it's a great metaphor for cultivating virtue, being of service and waking up. It's really versatile. And that's what we look to do, Lower Lights together.
Maybe we'll get into that metaphor a little bit, explore that metaphor a little bit.
Okay.
If you're interested in Faith Matter, we do at faithmatters.org has a lot of interesting things going on, and you can go to faithmatters.org and find out what we're doing as well. So what when we first met at dinner, and our wives were both there, and what I heard was this incredibly interesting story, and I've never heard anything quite like it before. I was aware before we went to dinner that you had had a deviation from the standard Mormon path, and so you gave us a little bit of a summary of that story, and it's not the story that we typically hear or maybe like to hear, because the story we like to hear, there's a common narrative of the the wayward, the person that takes another path. And then at some point realizes that they've made a dreadful mistake and need to shed whatever has accreted to them over that journey, which is we typically think of as sin or, practices that are harmful or whatever. And there's something to that, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in your case, I didn't hear that story. In fact, what I heard was someone who had taken a pilgrimage away from Mormonism in some ways and then returned bearing gifts. And in some ways, gifts that were a little exotic.
I like that.
Yeah.
That can be exotic.
How would you characterize that? What would you like to add to that? We're going to talk about that personal story a lot in this conversation.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that introduction. I mean, a place it occurs to me to start is that, I really stubbornly staged a protest when I was 13 years old growing up, and just I was not going to go to church, and I made good on that commitment not to go for many years. It was about 18 years later when I had, you know, kind of traveled all around the world and lived everywhere in Europe and China, west and east coast of the U.S. And when I started going back to church, I was really surprised, you know, to be honest. I didn't see myself going back to church. It didn't really occur to me. I think people were surprised that I had gone back to church. Like, we didn't see that coming, 20 years gone. And I think what was even more surprising to the people who were surprised that I was going back was how little I had changed going back, meaning I didn't leave the Buddhist behind. I didn't leave the mystic behind. That all felt integral to who I'd become. And it felt like a key piece in not just my journey, but the human journey. I think of what Mormonism, as I understand it, as I read the history and become more intimate with the characters, the people who founded Mormonism and helped build it, by definition, Mormonism was this great wandering, this undertaking of gathering truth from the four corners and bringing it home. And, you know, like everybody, I'm living my own life and looking to honor that call.
Yeah, and that's not a narrative that we use much, but I was before I came here, I kind of remembered a quote. Do you mind if I read it?
Love it, yeah.
Brigham Young said, "Mormonism, so called, embraces every principle pertaining to life and salvation for time and eternity, no matter who has it. If the infidel has got truth, it belongs to Mormonism." And then he said, "It is the business of the elders of this church to gather up all the truths in the world pertaining to life and salvation, to the gospel we preach, to the sciences, and to philosophy, wherever it may be found in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, and bring it to Zion." That's a high bar.
Yeah. Thank you, Brigham Young, for that. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great challenge. I can, so the gifts that you returned with to bear to Mormonism, I see as, I could put generally into two categories, but I think they're very closely related, so intertwined as to become indistinguishable at some point. One of them is this practice of mindfulness or meditation. We can give a little definition of that in a second. And the other one is this idea of what you called adult development, which is sort of this idea of how we grow throughout our adult, or can grow throughout our adult lives. Not that we can't get stuck and not grow, because that certainly happens. But what those two things, sort of mindfulness and adult development married together, which is why you call your podcast Mindfulness Plus, because it's not just mindfulness, but it's married to that idea of, in that context of how we grow and develop.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You want to riff on that a little bit?
Well, there's a lot to say about both of them. I mean, yeah, if I had to boil it down into two practices, I would say that. Yeah, mindfulness, contemplation, people call it different things.
Right.
And this burgeoning field of research that we call adult development, and just how much we're learning about the adult mind, how much it changes and transforms, how across a lifespan we can fundamentally evolve the way we experience ourselves, experience others, how we interpret and make meaning of life. And in a Mormon context, and in my experience of really working with some of the most talented people in the world in this field, the people who show real maturity, the people who really manifest adult development, as we're using the term, they're the kind of people you're around, and it feels like a sacrament. It feels like there's something divine in them. There's something divine in all of us, right? Let's be clear about that. But there's something about people who just absolutely dedicate themselves to growth in the spirit. Mormonism is an incredible tradition that does that in beautiful ways, I think in ways we don't see in other world traditions. And adult development, in my experience, helps us cross-train. It helps us see in a new way, maybe places that Mormonism hasn't quite filled out yet, places where we could grow more and manifest more gifts of the Spirit that we're just beginning to understand. Mm-hmm. So this adult development, it's this field of research, and more importantly, it's a practice. It's a way of being that helps us really fill out the potential of who we are and who we can become.
Yeah, when I remember when I first heard you speak about adult development, and you actually kind of marched us through stages that we sort of march through, that we grow through, even from infancy through adolescence and into adulthood. The concepts can seem a little, upon first hearing, they can seem a little theoretical. But I thought it's interesting enough that I thought I'm going to really try to make a follow this thing through and see where it leads. Where I found that it led for me, and I can say that the reason I would say whoever's listening to this should take this seriously and maybe give it some attention. I think what it really does is it maps out how that as you grow as an adult you can inhabit different perspectives.
It's one of the best definitions for adult development I've come across. Development, in a sense, is just referring to our ability to take different perspectives, to manage, to integrate, to synthesize different perspectives. You know?
And we're used to talking about that in terms of growing in charity, for example.
Yeah, I love that, Bill. And just to make it really tangible for listeners right now, think about somebody in your life that you have some kind of conflict with right now, somebody you have a disagreement with, somebody you don't see eye to eye with. It could be a spouse. You've got a momentary scuffle going on and you haven't quite, smoothed it out yet. It could be somebody at work. Notice in yourself, which perspective is more difficult to inhabit. Notice the perspective that feels like, what's that person thinking? Why can't they just get with the program, whatever you think the program is? And feel that stretch as you kind of relax into the other person's perspective.
And at first it feels like discomfort and then it stretches and then you begin to be able to actually inhabit the other person's perspective, and then understanding emerges, and then charity has space to emerge,
grow in that space. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if I were to just take it to the end game, and we'll have more time to get into depth with adult development, but as a simple definition of God or a simple concept of God, it's that ability to completely and fully inhabit every perspective with absolute compassion.
There you go.
Yeah.
When we talk about mindfulness and meditation, and sometimes those two words are almost used synonymously. As I understand, meditation is some practice that you sort of commit to, where you block out some day and you actually have this sort of practice. It can be part of your morning ritual or whatever. And in that, you sort of cultivate mindfulness. But mindfulness is more the way you look at the world. It's more the way you become aware of the world, right? So that's kind of can sort of emerge, greater mindfulness can emerge from meditation. But if meditation is a tool, mindfulness is maybe the goal of a meditative practice. Is that a fair way to say it? One is...
Yeah, I think that's all accurate. I'll start just by kind of clarifying terms. Mindfulness and meditation and contemplation, and those words are often used interchangeably. Meditation has more of a connotation that you're sitting still, eyes closed, doing something formally and deliberately. And like you pointed to, mindfulness, it includes that. There's formal mindfulness practice where you're sitting still and eyes closed in silence. But it also has a connotation, mindfulness, of getting up and walking around with it. Like, it's just your awareness, whether you're sitting, standing, lying, eating, sleeping, dreaming. It's the awareness that lights up your experience moment to moment. And we live in an interesting moment, this year, 2017, we're recording. And there is a raft of scientific literature on how meditative practice really changes even our physiology, how it rewires our nervous system. It can rev up the baseline of concentration we have, and that change the way that we attend to the world, attend to life moment to moment. I mean, it changes the fabric of our being over time, and it's catching on. More people are interested in learning it.
It's huge. Yeah. It's on the cover of Time magazine, on the newsstands. Yeah, so it's the time is right, I think, for us as a Mormon community to say, hey, what is in this? What is potentially in this for us? Mm-hmm. What can we learn from this? And so you bear these gifts. So tell us, let's just dive a little bit into your story and start where you want to start. And let us absorb your experience.
Sure, yeah. Would you like me to start at the very beginning?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Well, when I start at the very beginning, like many people, I think, I had a kind of predisposition to spirituality when I was really young. I felt really connected to the world. I was brought up in a really loving Mormon home. And the language we have around what this whole life is about was incredibly rich for me. And I had this unmistakable sense that I had a heavenly father and mother who cared about me very deeply and were concerned for my well-being, and that I could open my heart to them and I could direct my attention toward them and ask for help and ask for guidance. And I felt that help, I felt that care and that guidance from them, you know, throughout childhood. So I'm grateful to the Mormon tradition for instilling in me at the very beginning of life the awesome realities, you know, beyond the immediate, you know, sensory experience we might be having.
And when you say Mormon tradition, let's face it, there is no more traditional Mormon name than Worthland McConkie.
Right, and, you know, Thomas S. Monson.
Thomas.
He was friends with my granddad at the time, so my parents said, we're naming this one Thomas.
Yeah, and your granddad is?
Joseph B. Worthland.
Sure.
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in a Mormon family on the Wasatch Front, and, you know, my neighborhood was probably 95% Mormon. I mean, it was a stronghold.
Your grandfather was Oscar McConkie, so the...
Is. Still living.
Yeah, still living.
Oscar
90-some years old.
92.
Yeah. And his brother was famous Bruce R. McConkie, so you grew up swimming in those McConkie waters.
Yeah, that's right.
Oscar's founder, one of the co-founder of Curtin McConkie, which is the church's law firm. Yeah. And, I've actually hired them to do a little work for me years and years ago. Seemed like they did pretty good work, and I was surprised at the bill, but I probably didn't hear that a lot.
you
probably get the family rate, so you don't have the same experience. But yeah, very, very capable, accomplished family in a lot of ways. And in some ways, which you'll probably get into there's a little bit difference in culture between the McConkie side and the Worthland side, and but we'll get into that when you get into it. So
No, that was an amazing lesson growing up, seeing how differently very sincere Mormons can express the tradition. So I hope we can revisit that.
Sure.
Yeah. I absolutely loved growing up as a Mormon. It meant everything to me. And, you know, to this day, when we talk about feeling the spirit, I mean, my body, my physical tabernacle is wired to feel the spirit. Because I grew up, it's like learning your mother tongue, and you speak with a perfect native accent because that's the environment you were brought up in, and your body, mind was, you know, grown to do that. And, you know, to this day, when I feel moved by the spirit, when I feel moved by, you know, divine power, I've been feeling that my whole life, thanks to, you know, a really rich tradition and a family that was sensitive to those currents. So
And maybe there's something in the DNA as well. Maybe there's something to that.
Maybe. Yeah. I think there's an argument for that. So I had such a rich experience growing up in the church. And, you know, it was really interesting. I'll tell the story that I told. I recently did a conference special.
Right between sessions of General Conference, you injected a little McConkie in there.
There you go. Yeah, it was actually more Worthland than McConkie.
It was.
The story is about my granddad Worthland. I was 12 years old. I was in sixth grade at the time, I remember, and I was supposed to go skiing with my friends the next day at Park City, and it was a great snow day. That was back, you know, in the early 90s. That's when we used to get, you know, 20 feet of snow in the winter in Utah. And I came down with the worst fever of my life. I mean, I remember just going pale and trembling. And I remember my parents just having a talk about how serious is this? What do we do with this kid? Do we wait it out through the night, give him some aspirin? Should we take him to the hospital? And I remember my mom turning to me and she said, "Would you like a blessing from your granddad?" This is my granddad, Worthlin. And he lived just a few blocks away. And it was just like the moment she asked me that question, something in me opened up, something lit up. And I said, "Of course I want a blessing. That sounds like the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my whole life." And, you know, my granddad was a busy guy. He was an apostle at the time. And I imagine he dropped everything and drove up and kicked the snow off his boots and came in from the cold, wet night. And the family went into the living room and the man laid his hands on my head. And it was absolutely transcendent what happened to me in that moment. I mean, I was 12 years old. I didn't have any language to comprehend what was going on, or limited language to make sense of it. But I knew by the direct experience in my body that there was a power and a light moving through me that was not of this world, you could say. And I literally felt the fever baking out of my fleshly body. So much so that by the end of the prayer, I just about sprang up out of the folding chair. And I remember after my granddad left the house that night, I was just bounding around. I had more energy than I'd ever had.
Yeah. Did it transform you in any other way? I mean, did you feel anything else that maybe was something that you didn't expect or beyond what you could have expected from that experience?
In every way, it changed me. I mean, it changed my sense of how thin the veil is. It changed my sense of what priesthood power means. It changed my sense of what it means to be a priesthood holder and the privilege that is and the opportunity to bless with that power it is. It changed so many things. It was as literal a miracle as I cared to experience in my life at that time. My granddad could have raised someone from the dead in that same night, and it wouldn't have been more surprising to me than that faith healing.
Yeah. And well, I ask that question because when I've had experiences like this in my own personal life, whatever you're after, in this case, you were after a blessing to recover from, you know, a fever that was, you felt at that time was severe enough that you were really worried about it and your parents were really worried about it. In my case, I may have been after forgiveness or guidance, and you receive this overwhelming experience, but you get a lot more from it typically than you ask for. I mean, than what you're after. In some case, you feel a degree of love or connection with other people that almost surprises you. It's almost like you can't have that experience you can't touch the divine without also being touched by that.
Right.
And having that, and so it's transformative in ways that you typically don't even expect.
It reminds me when quantum physicists talk about the quantum universe, and they say, I can't remember which scientist said this. They said, the universe isn't only stranger than we supposed, it's stranger than we can suppose.
Yeah.
You know, to your point, I think divine and transcendent experience, it's the goodness of it, the generosity of it, the healing power of it, the universal love that comes through, it enters through from the heavenly realms into the earthly realms. It's more transcendent than we can even imagine.
Yeah.
It just overcomes us. And I, you know, as a little 12-year-old, it was, you know, almost too much to hold in that little body.
And then you had another experience that I don't know if we want to talk about. I will just say that in this conversation, we'll cover some of your life, but we won't cover we'll cover some highlights, but it is a
strange and remarkable story, to say the least. And if you want to get it all, it's going to be in book form here. But we'll so I don't know how much you want to talk about. You had another experience about this time in your life that we may want to just defer till later, or you can talk about it now.
I think so. I think I'll hold off on that. I mean, it was another experience with my granddad Worthlin. It took place in the temple. He was dedicating a temple, and our family was invited to come. Watch the dedication. And, you know, another moment where it was clear beyond any doubt that something's going on.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. Something is absolutely going on.
So then... Oh, sorry.
Said, read the book.
For that and a lot of other reasons, read the book. But it's not out yet. We have to say it's still a work in progress. But I get the privilege of actually reading the drafts of these chapters, and so I'm going to prompt you, and you can respond or not respond, sure, as the case may be. I will say what's remarkable here, though, is so here you have these experiences. This is obviously, the church is obviously God's church. It's obviously true. You've got these servants of God who have personal, you experience it in a very personal way. Mm-hmm. It's nourished you in ways, except where it didn't. Mm. And then it's true, and then maybe not so true. And you go through, you have this, how after all of these experiences, how could you ever doubt the divinity of your religious community or faith? How did you ever depart from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe we could go to break, but we don't have breaks here. It's an audio program. That really is the question. I was just at the church office building the other day, you know, presenting to the education department on mindfulness and development. And somebody asked more or less that same question. You know, they said, if you've like really experienced what you have, how could you leave the church for so long? How do you manage that? And I can't remember. I wish I remembered what I said to him at the moment. I could use that answer about now.
It was pretty good.
I think it was good. I think I Kung Fu Panda'd him. I don't ever remember doubting divinity, actually, in terms of just the awesome, open-ended nature of reality and the mystery. I mean, I think to this day, I'm a meditator. I'm a, you know, an amateur mystic, we'll say. And I think that probably has everything to do with some of the experiences I had as a child. And I was also really willing to look at what stank, to me anyway, in the culture, you know, problems that I saw in the pageantry of Mormonism and where we were failing one another in relationship in the church. It wasn't an unmanageable contradiction to me that my granddad could have priesthood and healing power and that, you know, other members could be, you know, abusing their privileges and that, you know, we gotta tighten things up around here.
Yeah, but for most people, that's fairly easy to reconcile. You say, yeah, we fall short of divine, but the divine's there. Mm-hmm. So we don't. I probably saw some of those same things. You were probably more observant than I was as a child, but I probably saw some of those same things. I just ignore it, more or less expected that of my neighbors and family.
Yeah.
Was there something about your Mormon experience, though, that wasn't nourishing you or making you feel like somehow alien to the culture of the church? What was the root of that sort of emotional estrangement that you experienced? Let's talk about that.
So,
but the reason I bring this up is because I think it's actually more common than we think.
Yeah.
And more common as time goes on. I think we're seeing this, what you went through, I see happening a lot, and it's in our families. So anyway, let's get into that a little bit.
I appreciate this. And, you know, surprisingly, I have a brand new response that's never occurred to me until this moment.
Good.
So I want to share it. I agree with you. I mean, I think on a certain level, it is kind of strange and arbitrary that I think a lot of people experience the hypocrisy of members in any religion they're a part of, and it probably doesn't bother them to the extent that it bothered me. And as you put that question to me just now, Bill, a polarity arises in my mind. And, you know, I love talking polarity because it's so Mormon. It's one of these understated Mormon principles that in all things there needs be opposition.
Yes.
But that not only that there needs to be an opposition, but all things are a compound in one.
Yeah.
So when we read
opposition
those,
does not mean trial or adversity. It literally means there are polarities.
There are opposites.
Yeah, opposites.
And if they're a compound in one, it suggests a prior unity. It suggests that these opposites need one another to be one and to be whole. So male, female, masculine, feminine, there are all of these dancing polarities in the universe that we can't be whole without. And it occurs to me as we're kind of reflecting on this strange rebellious streak of mine from a young age that, you know, there were Worthlands and there were McConkies. And it's no coincidence that Oscar W. II founded Curtin and McConkie, and that his gift, I think a spiritual gift of his, is justice. I think he understands justice in a deeper way spiritually than I ever could. And on the other side of the aisle, I didn't know how to say this at the time growing up, but I didn't ever experience mercy like I did with anybody but my granddad Worthlin.
Yeah.
And I think if I'm just going to speak really honestly in this moment, I think I sensed too much justice in the mixture for me at that age. It felt like in our immediate family, we were too oriented towards doing the right, obeying the law. And something in me cried out for the mercy. It cried out for forgiveness. And sure enough, I mean, it's strange how intuitive that act of, I remember one Sunday morning, I just decided, I can't go to church today. It was like my body physically
at
revolted.
Age?
I was 13 years old. So this is probably within 12 months of the miracle healing, mm-hmm. right? This is how close in time these events are unfolding. And I remember it wasn't like this idea like, huh, like I'll just try that. It was like, I mean, it was an idea, but deeper than that, it was this physical revulsion where I didn't think I could bear to get up, get dressed, and like set foot into the chapel because there was something about it that felt so wrong to me. And it was a really challenging moment I had with my father that day when he got back. I mean, I had seven siblings, so people are scurrying around. They get out the door as fast as they can. It's madness trying to get to church. No one noticed. I was like Kevin from Home Alone. No one noticed that I didn't go to church. But they noticed, like, you know, at some point during the meetings that I wasn't there. And, you know, my dad came back. He was so upset with me that I hadn't gone to church. And I say this out of love for my father because, you know, there are stories in the McConkie family. I remember a story that we're told where, you know, Bruce was learning the concept of agency in Sunday school. So imagine little Bruce before he was 6'5" and master scriptorian of the universe. Mm-hmm. He was learning about agency in Sunday school, and he went to his dad, Oscar Sr., in Monticello, Utah, and said, Dad, and you know, we learned all about agency today. And, you know, I realized that I actually have a choice whether or not I'm going to go to, whether or not I need to go to church or not. And I decide today to not go to church. And as the story goes, this is McConkie family lore. It's apocryphal, but I think it could have happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, Oscar kind of smiles at Bruce and he says, I'm proud of you, son. You've grasped the concept of agency. Now get your jacket. We're going to church.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe every family has a story like
this. So this echoed two generations later and played out a little bit differently this time.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I mean, like, you know, for me, it was this clash of wills with my father. How many people in the Mormon church throughout time have felt this pain between the law and mercy?
Yeah, and it's not just that. There's a sort of a legalistic way of looking at things where the gospel can become a system of prescribed beliefs and rules. Somehow something is not resonating with you. It's somehow something about you, the way you're experiencing the church,
and the way you're conceiving the gospel is just, you say it to you, you use the word stink, but yeah, just didn't fit. You said, I think
respectful.
I have a nose.
No offense, anybody. Yeah.
It wasn't connecting with you somehow.
Yeah.
And is there something about your, what is it about your personality or about the way your brain's wired that doesn't connect with that?
Good question. I mean, if I were to put that all in a single word, I would say I was sensitive to feeling coerced. I sensed coercion in the environment. And for whatever reason, I wasn't going to get on board with it. I was stubborn enough that I sensed the coercion and I was going to push against it. And I'm not here to say that Mormons have the monopoly on coercion. I think it's a human quality.
Oh, listen, if my son had told me or my daughter told me at age 13, hey, I'm not going to church anymore.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're a member of the family. This is what we do. It's not going to kill you. Just, go to church.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, we could chase this mystery a good long time. Like, why did it happen that way where I stopped going to church that day? And the confrontation with my father was challenging enough that, like, that really set me on a new trajectory in life. I don't know. I can say, sitting in this chair right now with you talking to you, I'm incredibly grateful for that grace, for that confrontation we had and for the journey it sent me on. And I wouldn't love the gospel. I wouldn't love Christ. I wouldn't love the church the way I do today had I not, gone far afield out into the wilderness. So it's amazing how our life gifts us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was painful.
Incredibly.
I mean, having the sons and daughters need the approval, seek the approval of their parents. And there's a particular role that the father plays where if you're not getting approval from your father, you feel like there must be something fundamentally wrong with me.
I appreciate you bringing that up. That was very much the case for me. I felt like a failure. I felt ugly. I felt unworthy. I felt a lot.
Were you feeling that before that day?
Yeah, to an extent. And that's a good point. It's not like everything happened in that moment. Mm-hmm. Things happen gradually until they happen suddenly. And I think something, in the Eastern schools, they call it karma. There was a long chain of cause and effect across the eons that had been playing out. Mm. And it boiled over in a way that I remember that particular event that day with my father. But yeah, there was trouble in paradise before I stopped going to church. It was building. Yeah. Adolescence is hard enough to just get used to this, freakish new body you're coming into and, starting to differentiate from your family and realize everyone's crazy and you just want to be with your friends and, your siblings aren't as cool as they used to be. That was hard, but then compounded with, there was a real narrative going through our family that goes through the whole church, I think, that I was living in sin. I mean, I was 13 and I just knew I didn't want to go to church, but that made me sinful and that made me unworthy. And, it really just about collapsed me psychologically. It was a really hard time. I don't mean to make any light of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So what next? So what do you do? So now you're 13.
Yeah.
You've placed yourself outside of the McConkie paradigm for sure.
For sure, yeah.
We're going to get back to how your grandfather, Worthland, kind of reconnected with you and you reconnected with him. But let's talk about your teen years a little bit. And what was that like? Where'd you go with this? Once you've declared war by not deciding you're not going to attend church anymore, once you've that initial act of rebellion, a lot of dominoes start to fall for you psychologically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I put all of my energy in high school into being a really underperforming student and, an athlete. I was a swimmer and a water polo player. And, I think just the intense exercise, I probably exercised 4 hours a day in high school. And it's just something to put all of my life force into because I was so broken up over you know, just the catastrophe that was my family life. It was really painful.
And there was no like, hey, son, come here, sit on the couch. You know what? I'm going to just put his arms around you and say, you know what? We'll just see what happens here. It was like a standoff.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is still the early 90s in Wasatch Front, Salt Lake City, Utah. I don't think there was a lot of culture for that in the McConkie family.
Well, you were probably the first one that ever said, hey, I'm not going to...
Oh, yeah, I know I was.
You were the first.
It was a precedent. It was like we'd never been in this territory.
Right.
And, you know, my dad and I, we just didn't have the tools or the resources or the awareness to figure it out. Mm. And we both suffered with it tremendously, as did the rest of the family in their own way. I mean, you know, we really broke over it.
Yeah, it was this ever-present thing in the family that seemed, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you, so you've mentioned before that you had problems with depression and anxiety. Was that, did the onset of that occur after this sort of falling out, or was it?
It was about right at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of associated with adolescence.
Who knows what hormones are doing to an adolescent's brain and what is going on, right? It's like, it's a mystery and difficult to sort out.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I mean, nothing diagnosable. I didn't see any psychiatrists or doctors like that until I think I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a year or two after I'd stopped going to church and this family conflict was compounding. You know, at the time, psychiatry was really taboo. So even that, to get to a place that was bad enough that we consulted a doctor about it, that was groundbreaking.
That's admitting the failure of the gospel in your life to consult a psychologist.
I think
back
so.
Then. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we forget that. Going to therapy now is trendy. You want to have a therapist to help you process and grow. It's a growth modality, I think, in the 21st century. You know, where I was living in the early 90s, it was...
An admission of failure, kind of. Okay, So take us through your high school years and then what happened after that.
Well, I mean, there are various incriminating details to those high school years, so I'm not sure how much you want me to share, Bill.
Well, yeah.
I can only share so much.
I think the statute of limitations has expired on...
Yeah. High school was a really painful time. I remember taking my first drink when I was 13 years old. It was summertime. And, you know, when you come from the kind of family I do, that many of us do, I don't just mean who cares about general authority families. I'm just talking about devout Mormon families that dedicate their lives to the faith. I mean, you know the line you're transgressing when you take a drink. And I mean,
I transgressed that same line at age 13. It's interesting.
There you go, 13 years old. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's interesting. It was this... I remember the most exciting thing about taking my first drink when I was that young was the way it defined me against what I wasn't.
Hmm.
Not the positive definition of this is who I am, but the liberation I felt from this is who I'm not. Because I'd felt so rejected by family, by community, by church, it was actually psychologically relieving for me to cross that line and say, like, I'm done with you people, I'm out. And, you know, that led me down
that
the
ritual
road.
First drink, yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't ever develop, like, maybe an addiction to alcohol, but, you know, certainly that was something in my life that was, it was just... It was part of my new identity.
Sure.
As like the un-Mormon, right? And as I look back on it, I realize, you know, I really was emotionally devastated by the fracture with my family. And so, you know, I think it's justified to call it self-medicating through high school, whether it was alcohol, whether it was marijuana, or whether it was excessive exercise. I was doing everything I could to just, like, keep my mind off of the loss I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah, just trying to cope, really.
Okay, so where'd that go?
Where did that go? Well,
high school. You graduated from high school.
We took the state champs in 1998, nice. East High Water Polo. It took me, you know, kind of a lot of nowhere. I felt pretty beat up by the time I got out of high school. My senior year of class, I dropped all my classes. So I was basically a high school dropout and, you know, ended up graduating high school just by the skin of my teeth. And yeah, it's just kind of how
with your mother helping you do packets or like that's what we do now.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, without my mom, I wouldn't have graduated high school on time. She tried to keep my life on the rails as much as she could. And it wasn't going to stay on the rails. I remember I got to a place where, I mean, I just felt like I'd been doing battle with the family, doing battle with the culture, just something in me that I'll let the listener interpret it. I actually don't know what was going on. I don't have an exact story to tell about it, but that I was revolting from the environment I was brought up in because something about it felt so wrong to me. And it's clear how unhealthy my response to it was. I mean, you know, you can't shake a stick at all the mistakes I was making along the way. And yet, I also want to honor myself and that path I was already on because there was something so deep in me that said, I'm actually going to see this through. Like, I've got this sense that this whole world needs rebalancing, and I'm determined to discover what that rebalancing looks like.
You actually had that thought in your late teens.
Different language. I didn't talk like I do now as a stoned 18-year-old. Maybe I did when I was stoned. That's a joke. But I mean, I definitely had this sense like I was on to something. I always trusted my instincts at a really deep level that, I mean, it was obvious too. I mean, just at the surface level of I decided I don't want to go to church and all hellfire is raining down on me. And that is not consistent with my understanding of mercy. Just on a very basic level, I knew that something's not right about this. Like when someone doesn't go to church, when a teenage girl gets pregnant, when somebody is converted from Mormonism to Islam, like when all these things happen that aren't in the narrative, I knew at that time that the response should be, we love you, we celebrate you, we'll work with this. Yeah. And I knew I wasn't seeing that in my own life. And I wasn't just going to cow down. I wasn't going to recant and say like, oh, life would be so much better if I just went back to church. It would have been amazingly better had I just gone back to church. Or, you know, if I just went on a mission, I could turn this
Well, there
around.
You go. See, that's how everything resolves. Because a lot of us were not, you know, took a little bit of a different path in adolescence. But out there, looming, is this time when you have to decide what it is that you believe, when you have to decide to make those tough decisions and go on a mission because that's what makes everything better is that mission, right? That's what's going to redeem your misspent youth. And that is actually a formula that works very well. Well, I'm not saying going off the rails part. That's not necessarily a part of it.
It doesn't work very well. I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, I mean, I just that's the narrative, right? It's more or less expected that you're going to do some wandering during adolescence, but then there's that time when it's time to decide if you're a Mormon or not, 19, right?
Yeah.
So that date, I'm assuming, loomed in your mind as well. There was something in some cultural expectation that sort of was always there, right?
I remember.
That is when the prodigal returns.
Yeah. Right? May 20th, 1999. I remember the day I turned 19, and I remember just feeling more nausea in my body than I'd ever felt in my life. Like, I couldn't believe the energy I was feeling from the family, from the culture, from the community. I hadn't been to church in 6 years. Count them, 6 years. This was a long time. I'd done everything I could to disidentify with the faith and say, look, this is who I am. Live with it, right? Love me for this, because that's what the church is all, that's what Christ's gospel is all about. I think I had that kind of self-righteous idea in my mind. And I remember feeling like the walking dead when I was 19 years old, that very day when I hadn't put in my papers, I wasn't at the MTC, I was just some 19-year-old
Your
schmuck.
Life has now officially become meaningless.
It was forfeit. Yeah. There's nothing. I mean, I remember having this feeling exactly like it didn't matter what happened on my 19th birthday, because the day after my 19th birthday, it just falls off a cliff because there's nothing left after that. And I wasn't expecting that, actually. There was nothing that could have prepared me for that. I sensed the profound disappointment from my family. I imagined the profound disappointment as it was something of both. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I just felt totally devastated. I hadn't felt that kind of worthlessness in my life up until that point. And
I don't imagine there was anyone else in your life that would have anticipated that day even held special meaning to you in that kind of a way. It's like,
yeah,
I mean, you would just imagine, well, it's just that the tyranny of that expectation is not always obvious, but we need to, part of what I'm hearing is, boy, we need to be aware of that because.
Yeah, I think that's insightful to say. Yeah, I don't know how conscious it was for any of us. I think, you know, these cultural patterns, they're baked into us. Yeah. You know, like when you walk into a chapel, you sing an opening hymn. When you turn 19 and you're a young, worthy male, you go on a mission and all that stuff. And I think something just like this flip switched in all of us, like 19, you know what to do. About face, head to the MTC, it's fine. Like, everything's forgiven if you just go on a mission. And I mean, that really, those 2 or 3 weeks, I can't remember how long it was before I fled. I fled Utah.
Two or three works of non-personhood in Utah, the way you looked at it. That's the way you perceived yourself.
Yeah, it was just the darkest time in my life. I felt like it was absolutely suffocating. And, you know, it was just a matter of days before I caught myself fantasizing about dying. Just like, what would it take to just die right now?
Actually having ideation of suicide at this point.
Yeah. And it was totally involuntary, which is what really struck me. It wasn't this willful, I'm going to sit down and pen a final letter. It was, I was in so much existential pain that, you know, the most spontaneous natural act in the world was for the mind to start imagining its own.
And you've been you've been essentially gone from Mormonism for 6 years, but not gone at all.
Right, because
the hold that it has on you,
right,
even during that time, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
So when you said you fled.
Yeah, I literally got up in the middle of the night. I didn't tell anyone where I was going, packed a few clothes, grabbed my debit card. I'd been bussing tables, had a few $1,000, and I left town. I bought a ticket at the counter, flew to California, and took my mom 2 weeks to track me down.
Ah, wow.
Yeah.
And that was devastating 2 weeks for her, I'm sure. Like, I can't imagine what that...
You know, I should ask her about that.
Yeah.
I haven't asked her how she felt during those 2 weeks. We spoke for just a few minutes on the phone. I finally picked up. I was impressed that she found me. And there wasn't much to say. I just said I needed to go. And she understood, I think.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll pick up on that story. We'll pick that up a little bit later.